now is 8:50, 8:31 on May 18th, 2022. I call the meeting of the Complaint Screening Committee of the Arizona Board of Psychologists Examiners to order. Ms. Michelson, could you provide the roll call?
Yes, Madam Chair. Dr. Davis-Wilson?
Present.
Thank you. Dr. Malott?
Present.
Ms. Shreve?
Present.
We have quorum and may proceed.
Great, thank you. The Complaint Screening Committee, pursuant to Arizona Revised Statute 32-2081H, may dismiss a complaint appearing on this agenda or refer them to the full board for consideration and action. Complaints dismissed by the committee shall not be disclosed in response to a telephone inquiry or placed on the board's website pursuant to ARS 32-2081H1. Upon a vote of the majority of the quorum, the committee may go into executive session under any item on the agenda pursuant to ARS 38431.03A2 to review confidential records or subsection A3 to receive confidential legal advice from our board's attorney, Ms. Galvin. For those in attendance, please be aware that the chair reserves a right to change the order of the items on the agenda based on the parties present. This is very important to everybody. Please only use initials when talking about patients or children and the complainant. Be aware that the content of many records included in the complaints is confidential, and the content should not be discussed in a public meeting. Be advised that the committee will go into executive session to discuss any confidential records. A person or a representative of a person who has filed a complaint and is present at today's meeting may make a brief statement to the committee up to 5 minutes only when prompted by the chair. Additionally, the licensee or respondent who is subject to the complaint will also have an opportunity to make a 5-minute statement only when prompted by the chair. The committee will also ask questions of the complainant or respondent after their statements are made. Please note that only individuals directly involved in the complaint, which are the complainant and the respondent, may address the committee and make a statement. If the committee wishes to hear from other parties, it will make this request during the case review. For everyone in attendance today, please ensure that your audio remains on mute. When prompted by the committee to speak, the complainant, respondent, and their legal representative may unmute themselves at that time. Please note individuals in attendance who speak out without committee approval will be warned twice by the chair not to interrupt. If the interruption continues after the second warning, the individual will be removed from the Zoom meeting and not permitted to re-enter. The first item on our agenda today is complaint number 22-19 for Dr. Michael Ellis. Dr. Davis-Wilson, you are the lead on this complaint. Would you like to provide a brief overview?
Yes, I will. Oh, hold on. And I do believe the licensee is Michelle Ellis. So in November of 2021, the board received a letter regarding concerns that a former patient had with Dr. Ellis. The board staff did respond to that letter and inform the individual that if they'd like to make a complaint, they needed to go through the complaint process. In January of 2022, on January 31st, they did receive the complaint, and two subsequent letters followed. The summary of the complaint is as followed. A former patient of Dr. Ellis was concerned regarding the status of a master's degree student performing services. She was under the impression that this individual was supposed to provide therapy to herself. She states that she requested copies of the paperwork multiple times and was told by both the student and Dr. Ellis that the paperwork would be mailed to her. She noted that the student was being trained on how to ask for sessions, and that she felt that the level of the student's knowledge was potentially not that of a master's degree student. She notes that she was dealing with several other issues and felt as though she was being told that she had to come back for sessions. She is noting that she still to date has not received the paperwork that she has requested. Dr. Ellis did provide a response via her attorney. She notes that her agency does make clear on the website the intake documentation and that the therapy is provided by master's degree students and postdoc fellows, as well as other individuals who are working toward licensure. She does note that the agency is a private clinic that offers low-cost sliding scale therapy and other services. She outlines that the complainant was scheduled for an intake appointment on November 9th. And that the intake appointment would be conducted with a graduate student. She did list only the first name of the graduate student and states that the patient did not ask for the last name, nor did she ask about the student's qualifications or a CV at any time. However, during the intake or during the initial phone call during the intake, she did inquire about the student's background and credentials, of which the student provided to her. They did provide informed consent through the intake, at which the student's full name was provided. That intake takes about 50 minutes. However, they note that the individual was unable to complete the intake paperwork on their own, and so the student did have to complete large portions for her, and that that particular intake took 90 minutes. The student did relay that RB had requested her intake records. Unfortunately, the student was unable to remain in the session because it had already gone over by 40 minutes and she already had additional commitment. Dr. Ellis explained to the student that there was a process to release records and the records would need to be reviewed by her first and then assembled for the client. It was not a process in which mid-visit that documentation could be provided. During that conversation, the RB did come out of the bathroom and appeared flustered but not in distress. Dr. Ellis did greet RB, who made a comment about being tired due to the length of the intake. She did not hear from RB. Either students discussed a second session, but was later told by a student that she was hoping RB would return after all her medical appointments so that they could go over records, complete the intake, and begin the actual therapy. RB never stated that she would not be returning to complete the intake. And then based on their conversation, the student was aware that it may be a few weeks before RB could return to due to medical appointments. It was her impression that RB would call to follow up, scheduled follow up. However, Dr. Ellis nor the student ever heard from RB again after the initial intake. She does not have any records of RB requesting a release for records. And I think, let's see, nor did she sign any release form. On January 31st, Dr. Ellis sent a letter to RB inquiring if she would like to come into the office and review her records and receive a copy. The typical procedure at the agency is a request for medical records is filled out in writing. However, if RB had simply called the agency and requested the records be mailed to her, the accommodation would have been made with verbal authorization to mail. Dr. Ellis indicated that if she did not hear back from RB by February 7th, the intake documents would be mailed to her. RB never responded to the letter, so Dr. Ellis mailed the intake paperwork to her by U.S. certified and regular mail. There seems to be some confusion as to which conversations took place. The licensee's response. But nonetheless, Dr. Ellis does state that RB has received all of her intake paperwork. We have been provided the clinical record, and Dr. Ellis does request that this complaint be dismissed. And that concludes my summary.
Thank you, Dr. Davis-Wilson. Is the complainant RB present with us today? Again, complainant RB, if you're here, if you could unmute yourself and introduce yourself and just let me know you're here. I want to give you an opportunity to make a statement. Okay, hearing nothing, is Dr. Ellis is here, and I believe also accompanied by her attorney, Ms. Burgess. If you would like to officially introduce yourselves, and then I'm not sure if one or the other or both would like to make a brief statement.
I'm Dr. Michelle Ellis. Hello to everyone. I think the only statement I would like to make is that the day of RB's intake, the reason that the intern thought she was returning is because she saw some coffee and said, I'll have to have some coffee on my next visit. The intern knew that she had a lot of medical appointments, didn't trust the medical community, had a lot of trauma. And so the intern waited, I think a week and a half, 2 weeks, and attempted to call her, I think, 3 or 4 times. She didn't have a smartphone, an answering machine, a recording, nothing, voicemail, nothing, no way to get a hold of her. So I continued to ask the intern, so what's going on? Have you heard from RB? Haven't heard. So finally she closed her case. That's when we received notice of the complaints. I called her 3 times, no answering machine, nothing. So then I sent her the letter that said we would like to meet with her again to go over the records, particularly with her to make sure that she understand what was written down. Never heard anything. So finally, just sent the records to her by both certified and regular mail. Never heard anything. That's it.
Thank you. We now might have some questions for you, if you don't mind. I think I'll start. Did you receive a certified letter receipt?
Yes, we did.
Okay. That's my only question. Other committee members?
Ms. Burgess, have anything that she wanted to add on behalf of her client?
I actually do not. My name is Robin Burgess. I'm here on behalf of Dr. Ellis. I am not the same RB. I was just wanting to make that clear, even though I have the same initials. But no, I think that the summary kind of covered it, and Dr. Ellis addressed the high points.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for clarifying that. All right. I'm not hearing any questions from my note. So with that, we're going to go into deliberations. Deliberations is a time when the committee members discuss amongst ourselves the case without any interruptions from anyone. Dr. Davis-Wilson, would you like to begin the deliberations?
Yes, Madam Chair. In review of this documentation, I do understand that some of the intake processes can be lengthy and they can be very overwhelming, especially for individuals that are flustered or in distress. I do think that the student did make attempts to support RB through the intake process. Despite the lengthy letters that have been provided and the length of the complaint, I'm not seeing anything that supports that that the student or Dr. Ellis did anything wrong or anything that would rise to a statutory violation.
All right. Thank you. I would agree with those comments. I don't see that there is a statutory violation. I think actually that they did their due diligence in trying to contact the client and actually sent her the documents, which is what she requested. Is there a motion? Or Dr. Malat, do you have any comments before? You're on mute, Dr. Malat. Yeah,
I agree with both of your assessments. They did due diligence. Dr. Ellis clearly indicates that, she also has interns. The RB was aware that the student was an intern during the process of the interview. I really don't see anything rising to a statutory violation. So I'll go ahead and, unless I leave that to Dr. Wilson to make a motion. So since it's...
I move that we go ahead and dismiss this complaint.
Second.
We have a motion and a second to dismiss. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. We're now going to move to next agenda item is 3B. This is a complaint number 22-22. Dr. Michelle Ellis, I am the lead on the case. I will provide a brief summary. And just as a caveat, a lot of this complaint references conversations that happened in a session, a counseling session. And because of that, it's considered executive session information because it's in a counseling session. So my overview is going to be very high level, and we can go into the details when we go into executive session. So Dr. Ellis was issued a psychologist license from the board in 1987. She currently maintains a practice in Tucson, Arizona called Palo Santos Psychotherapy and Wellness. Between January and February 2023, the complainant MS and her partner participated in three couple sessions with Dr. Ellis. MS sought out the services and then subsequently terminated the treatment after the third session. In February 2022, MS filed a complaint alleging that Dr. Ellis gave MS and her partner unsolicited medical advice during a therapy session. The licensee responded on April 13th, 2022. Board staff received the response via her attorney, Robin Burgess. Dr. Ellis, in the response, included all the clinical records, included signed forms by MS, the informed consent history, intake, treatment plan notes, termination notes, and billing information. Dr. Ellis saw MP and her partner three times during January and February 2022. During the intake, Dr. Ellis discussed the process, went over the informed consent, explored family history and other relationships. And then it goes into what occurred during the sessions. And I'm going to end it there as my brief overview, which is very brief. Is MS the complainant here? Okay, not hearing MS. Then Dr. Ellis, I know you're here with your attorney. This is typically when we would allow you an opportunity to do a brief statement, but I want to make sure that we can't say anything that happened in the session, which I think a lot of your comments would be possibly. So Ms. Galvin, should I have her give an overview without saying that, or can we just go into executive session?
I think if the committee and Dr. Ellis and Ms. Burgess feel that it would be more appropriate to go into executive session to avoid the inadvertent disclosure of confidential information, we could go ahead and go into executive session.
Dr. Ellis and Ms. Burgess, are you good with that?
Yes, I am.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Just want to confirm. Okay. So I will make a motion that we go into executive session in order to discuss case details and possibly advice from our attorney if needed.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor? Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, then we will move in executive session. You'll magically see a button that says join. Please just push that. I think we're all back. We're back in regular session. Are there any questions for Dr. Ellis? All right, hearing none, we'll now go into deliberations. Deliberations is a time where the committee members just discuss amongst ourselves without any interruptions. I am the lead. I'll go ahead and start the deliberations. Having reviewed this complaint and spoken to Dr. Ellis, I do not see any violations at all in any to the law, and I would recommend that this case is dismissed.
I'll second that.
Any discussion? Any further discussion? We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Again, Dr. Ellis and Ms. Burgers, thank you for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Have a good rest of your day.
Thank you. All right, moving to the next case is, through my notes here, items 3C, case number 22-23, Dr. Bio, is it Crago? I hope I pronounced that right. Sorry if I didn't. Dr. Malott, you are the lead on this complaint. Would you like to provide a brief summary?
I do. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Shree. Thank you, Dr. Crago, for being here. This complaint has been opened by the board staff regarding information we received from the Board of Behavioral Health Examiners. It is complaint number 22-23. And Dr. Crago has been licensed with this board since 1980. He has provided many, many years of service, and he has been in good standing this time, all this time. Dr. Crago supervised, or Dr. Crago had engaged, you know, had a LMSW, a licensed master social worker, work at his practice, and she will be referred to as MP. He provided supervision for this work. When MP decided to apply for independent licensure, she did not reveal the work with Dr. Crago. She sought the supervision of a licensed, an appropriate licensed professional to provide that supervision. In that interaction with the Board of Behavioral Health Examiners and the new supervisor, they learned that MP was working with Dr. Crago under Dr. Crago's license. According to the Board of Behavioral Health Examiners, they have very, very strict laws and statutes that govern the practice of supervised practice, and where you have to have, the agency has to be approved, the supervisor has to be approved, and it's very, very strict. And it's different from the Board of Psychological Examiners, where we don't have that pre-authorization in advance. Dr. Crago, you know, has indicated that he was not aware that, you know, he wasn't, you know, meeting the laws. MP, who kind of requested to work under him, also did not indicate, also indicated that she was not aware of the guidelines for supervision as an unlicensed clinical social worker. She was an LMSW. Anyway, the Board of Behavioral Health Examiners passed this information on to our board. Dr. Crago indicated that he was not aware. You know, he's been supervised, he supervised people in the past, mostly psychologists, and assumed that the regulations were the same. The social worker also appeared not to be aware. She was sanctioned by the Board of Behavioral Health Examiners for practicing, you know, without the proper supervision in place. Dr. Crago has returned all the money billed and has kind of decided not to take on any more supervisees so that he doesn't fall in violation. That concludes my initial summary of this case.
Thank you, Dr. Malott. Dr. Crago, we see you were here, and I believe you were represented by Dr. Akins.
Yes.
If you would like to provide any opening, well, first, if you both introduce yourself for the record, and then if one or both you wanted to do a brief statement.
Of course. My name is Farron Akins. I'm legal counsel for Dr. Crago. I'll let him introduce himself, and I know he has some words that he'd like to share with you. Thanks.
Yeah, it's actually Burrell, Robert Crago. And as to summarized, I'm a licensed clinical psychologist in Arizona for about 42 years. I have not had complaints as to date. My area of specialty was in rehabilitation psychology. I treat a lot of people with chronic pain, traumatic brain injuries, PTSD. A lot of my patients are disabled. I've also been very active in the area of biofeedback and applied psychophysiology, and can actually, with somewhat humility, say that I'm a pioneer in this area. participated in creating certification standards in this area. MP was a member of a QEG, EEG mentoring group that I was part of for several years. It usually had about 5 to 7 doctoral level therapists and a couple master's level therapists. MEP or MP had joined that group with an interest in biofeedback. She was quandering whether to try to get back to work. I took this into consideration because less than 3% of people on Social Security disability ever return to work. I had some unused office space, so I said, look, you can use this office space here on a limited basis, because I figured, it'd be pretty slow. It'd be a place where she could begin to do those things. I wanted to encourage her, actually, to, because I think it takes a lot of guts to try to get back to work after being disabled for several years. And I thought erroneously that I could legitimately supervise her because I have my own license. I've got 4 decades of experience. I also thought that I could legitimately bill for her services because she was being competently supervised, in these areas. And I've done this before for doctoral level people. As someone said, I simply was not aware that there was a big difference between the Board of Behavioral Health and psychology rules. And even though I'd taken some supervision courses in the past, that issue never seemed to have come up, the differences in those practices. Naively, I guess, I encouraged her when she told me she wanted to actually start looking to get credit to become an independent practitioner. I actually encouraged her to submit these hours and see what they would do. And she did submit those hours, not realizing that she was revealing that a violation had been committed. Neither MP or I wanted to commit fraud, and we immediately stopped that arrangement. Since that time, I've hired an attorney, Mr. Akins, who helped me learn and understand my errors. I also hired a second attorney that deals with Medicare to start that reimbursement. In fact, as someone said, we have returned all monies to Medicare at this point, over 17,001 and then a couple thousand more. As of yesterday, we have completed returning 4 patients who were giving paid us in cash. And we're currently trying to get to the third party. There's just a few third party behind Medicare that we're going to try to deal with that. Where I'm at in my career right now is in the past few years, I've just been gradually moving towards retirement. I took advantage of the pandemic and have greatly reduced my practice load. In January, the office closed. I moved to an executive office suite. I'm in solo practice now. I see about 12 to 15 patients a week, 3 days a week. I keep a couple of pro bono patients, which I've always done. I want to continue to work in private practice. I want to, in a part-time basis.
It's working.
I'm sorry. I want to continue to work on the International QEG Certification Board, where I chair the exam committee. I just want to remediate any mistakes I made, deal with my errors, and so I can continue on my journey towards, a reduced practice in retirement. I'm actually happy that MP did proceed towards getting off a disability and got a license, to my understanding. Along the way, I have becoming much more legally competent. I've redone my HIPAA forms, my consent to treatment forms, added a teletherapy form, although I don't do much of that. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to share with you my views or my opinions, whatever, and I'll be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Doctor, for those comments. Board members, do you have any questions for the doctor?
I didn't know if Mr. Akins had anything to add.
I'm sorry.
Dr. Akins, do you want to make any comments?
No, but thank you. We'll just wait to take any questions you may have.
All right, thank you. Board members, do you have any questions? So just
I had a question in, regarding the social work license. if she wasn't using it for supervised practice, you know, and towards licensure, and I guess I'm not aware of the social work license, so I have to admit that. I would have to go and read up all their statutes as well. Could she have provided services under your supervision? Would that have been illegal? That's what I'm trying to answer.
Well, what I've learned is there's actually three grades of social workers. There's MSW, LMSW, and then licensed clinical social worker. And to my understanding, none of them can work under my supervision unless I would be approved by their board.
No, and my question is, so they cannot provide any supervised practice. Even if they're not counting it towards supervision, you know, towards licensure requirements.
That's my current understanding, that board has very, you know, they have their own criteria.
Thanks. Thank you, Dr. Crago.
Dr. Crago, just to kind of, just to recap some of it is, it's our understanding from what you've said, what we've read is once you realize the mistake, it was, you approached it to determine how you, you know, what went wrong, what you should do. You have hired two different attorneys. You have made a payment back to Medicare, and are working on the other issues. So it appears you're doing your due diligence to rectify, mediate the situation. What have you learned from this experience?
To do my due diligence and probably get, get legal consultation, I guess. I had always gone to lawyers to look at my leases and stuff like that, but it just never occurred to me in this situation to that it would be any different. That I felt that she could, she had worked before, with her current acting non-licensed, I guess, that she could probably work under my license since I was a PhD psychologist. I just figured she could do that.
All right. Any other questions from the board members?
Ms. Shreve, may I just follow up to give a little more clarification on that? This was someone who had worked for many years in a variety of agencies, all regulated by the Department of Health Services. And the Department of Health Services doesn't have the same legal restrictions as far as being able to practice as the Board of Behavioral Health. And in fact, those two agencies at times do come in conflict with each other because their rules are rather different. So when Dr. Crago first met this individual, he was only aware that she had worked for many years in a variety of agency settings and presumed, I'm sure quite reasonably, without other knowledge, that this person must have a license. And therefore, all he needed to do was be able to supervise her cases, meet with her on a regular basis, and do the kinds of things you do if you were a psychologist supervising a psychology student or intern.
All right. Thank you. Any other comments? All right, hearing none. I would like to motion to go into executive session to get legal advice.
Second.
There are motion and a second. All in favor? Aye. Gotcha. Then we're going to move into executive session just for a minute. So please stay where you are and we'll be back shortly. Magically reappeared. We're back in regular session. Are there any further questions for the doctor or Mr. Akins? All right, hearing none, we will go into the deliberations. Deliberations is a time for the board member to speak amongst ourselves without any interruptions. Dr. Malott, I believe you're the lead. Would you like to start the discussion?
Yeah. Dr. Crago, as we know, has been licensed for 42 years. He allowed or invited an unlicensed social worker to work under his supervision. That also included billing for her services. He was not aware that that was a violation by the Board of Behavioral Health examiners. And it was something he's done in the past. He supervised psychologists who were not licensed and provided that supervision. When he discovered that this was not appropriate, he immediately seized that practice. He returned all of the money that was billed for the services, and he immediately changed his practice. And I felt like, he did everything to rectify a mistake. APA Code of Ethics 3.04 talks about avoiding harm. And it states that psychologists take reasonable steps to avoid harming their clients, patients, students, supervisees. In this case, this would be the supervisee, research participation, and other clients and others whom they work to minimize harm where it is foreseeable and unavoidable. This could have been avoided if there was a more closer inspection of another board statutes. And so more reasonable steps could have been taken. So I feel like, I would lean towards a letter of concern. I mean, a recommendation to the full board that we issue that based on, additional reasonable steps that could have been taken. And we appreciate what Dr. Craigo did in terms of really stopping it right away, returning the money even before it came to the board. So
are you, I'm sorry, so just to confirm, Ms. Gap, so it sounds like you're recommending a violation of ARS 322061DD, and then a violation of 3.04 avoiding harm with a recommendation to the board of a letter of concern.
Yeah.
So is that your recommendation?
That is my recommendation, and it could be a motion too.
That's what I meant. Is there a second?
I'll second that, but I also want to add that and this is probably just me being super picky about the language, but the identified kind of facts, so the findings of fact, I think that the reason why the letter of concern is an important distinction is because while they're important considerations, I don't know that it's raised to the statutory violation of. And so I just want to make sure that it's noted, because I know we've had in the past of similar concerns of, is there a violation or not? And I just want to make sure we clarify that there's concern, there's documentation and reason to have concern. But I think the letter of concern would be the appropriate avenue to approach that.
So in that case, then, and maybe Ms. Galvin, do we have to cite a specific statute violation when it's when we are recommending a letter of concern?
Your referral to the board is for a possible violation of 2061.
Okay.
Yeah, and then a letter of concern is the recommendation. And when it goes to the full board, then obviously the ultimate decision will be made. But this is the committee's recommendation, and the basis is a possible violation of 2061DD.
Okay.
All right. So Dr. Davis-Wilson, did you second?
I did.
Okay, thanks. All right, so we have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Thank you very much, Dr. Craigo and Dr. Akins. You'll be hearing from our staff in regards to the next steps.
Very good. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, moving to our final case.
Could we get a 2-minute break?
Yes, definitely a good idea. Why don't we take a break? It's now, roughly 9:35. Why don't we meet back in 10 minutes at 9:45? Give everybody 10 minutes to stretch, grab a snack, and we'll be back then. Thank you, okay. Everyone.
Thank you.
Here, do we need another roll call, or can I just begin? Are we good?
Just have a roll call.
All right.
Dr. Davis-Wilson?
Present.
Dr. Malott?
Present.
Ms. Shreve?
Present.
Okay, everyone is here.
All right, thank you. And welcome back, and thank you for being patient during the break. We're now on agenda item 3D. The next complaint to discuss is case number 2217 regarding Dr. David Weinstock. Dr. Malott, you are the lead. Would you like to provide an overview of the case?
Yes, thank you, Ms. Shreve. My name is Ramona Malott, and I'm a psychologist board member, and I'm here to provide the overview of complaint number 22-12 for Dr. Weinstock, who has been licensed since 2003 with a board. The complainant is SN, and who is the mother of this of the case. So I might use SN or mother, you know, alternatively during my overview. Dr. Weinstock serves also, besides being a licensed psychologist, serves as a board member for the Arizona chapter of the Association of Family and Conciliation Courts. SN has been, who filed a complaint, has been involved in a contentious custody case ongoing since 2016, including an order of protection from the father in 2018. In 2020, a psychologist issued a comprehensive family court evaluation report recommending that the family works with a TI, a therapeutic interventionist, and I'll use the TI abbreviation for the rest of my overview, to for the purposes of reunification. And the reunification is related for the father having, time spent with the daughter. Back in 2019, another TI was engaged. And is it okay for me to use the other TI's name, Ms. Galvin?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And the name was V. Hill, V. Hill in 2019. V. Hill resigned as a TI because things were not working out. Sorry, my phone turned on by itself. So she resigned because there was just a lot of contention and the realignment was not working. I read two different renditions of, either B. Hill was upset with the father because of his lack of cooperation, as well as the mother and the child's therapist. So that did not work out. B. Hill resigned. Then there was a Rule 69 agreement that was issued by the court on February 26, 2020. Rule 69 talked about four different things. Legal decision-making resides with the mother. The parties will defer to the therapeutic interventionists regarding father's parenting time schedule. Everyone involved in this matter, the family, the child, the parents, the mother, the father, will continue in therapy with a therapist of their choice. And they will select a therapeutic interventionist. And if they don't agree on who to select, then a court hearing will decide on who the TI should be. I mentioned earlier the initial appointment with Dr. V. Hill Sarda, I think is her last name, STI. She resigned in September 2020 because of the situations I described earlier. Dr. Weinstock was appointed on November 16, 2020. In June 28, 2020, there was a request to suspend the TI work as mother's attorney emailed him to question the legal basis and the appropriateness of the TI process, asked for the courts to schedule a status conference. Reading further down, and I'm going to mention it here, that appeal was denied. Mother asked for the TI appointment to be voided. This was after many months of receiving TI services that was denied. August 30th, 2021, Dr. Weinstock asked the courts to provide guidance on August, regarding what was going on through the TI process. On August 22nd, 2021, Dr. Weinstock recommended a Family Bridges program because he felt that that would really help with the reunification process. Dr. Weinstock indicated more sessions with all of the providers, including with the daughter, to assess the situation. Some of those sessions, it was very difficult to get scheduled. And ultimately, he decided that neither the mother nor the therapist was committed to the reunification process. He asked in his recommendations that these providers be replaced and that they be replaced with providers that are more familiar with the forensic process and that could really help meet the goals that was in the Rule 69 hearing that the TI, the reunification, they proceed with the reunification. Dr. Weinstock did review the notes made by the visitation monitor. There were several visits that happened between the father and the daughter. And he felt that those notes provided evidence of father's ability to contain his emotions and have reasonable interactions with the daughter. He felt that the discrepancy between the father's efforts and the daughter's behavior is symptomatic of parental alienation. Dr. Weinstock responded to the allegations made by the complainant, SN. He felt that the claim is not supported by the record. He acted within the scope of his authority. He disagreed with the views expressed by the mother and two professional does not mean that he was acting outside the bounds of his role or the scope of his authority. Mother's viewpoint on reunification was not the view of the court. And I mentioned that earlier, the Rule 69. He acknowledged concerns of reunification on both sides. Mother said that it was going too fast. Father indicated it was going too slow. There was also a claim made in the complainant that Dr. Weinstock said that domestic violence had not occurred. I read through the whole, there was a briefing by the father. It was a long, long transcript. And the father alluded to that in his comment. And then when questioned further, he said, well, I think the therapist said that. And it was more an inference if you read through that whole interview. Dr. Weinstock acknowledges that he did acknowledge findings of prior domestic violence. And he also hypothesized the daughter's reaction to observing domestic violence at age three. His role was to help daughter feel comfortable with the reunification as recommended by the court. However, he hypothesized that mother did not really want reunification, which then led to his recommendation for the Family Bridges program. So that concludes my summary of a very, very long case. And I will pause there for now. So,
all right, thank you, Dr. Mallott. All right, is the complainant SN here? We can't see you. We can see your arm. There you are. And I believe you are also represented by your attorney, Mr. Makuta.
Makuta. Yes.
Makuta. Thank you. This is your time to have if you'd like to make some opening statements, a brief statement, and then we may have questions for you.
Thank you.
And first of all, if you could both introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Kip Makuta here on behalf of Mother SN, who is seated to my left.
I am Mother SN, and I have sole legal custody of the child that is the center of this dispute.
All right, thank you. Do you have an opening statement that either would like to make?
I do. I'll make a statement, and then my client may have some comments, but we also recognize the committee may have questions. I don't take particular pleasure in appearing in this matter this morning. I'm here because I think it's essential I have been a board member and a chair to a similar board as this. I know the gravity of these decisions, and that's why I'm appearing here. Dr. Weinstock was improperly appointed as a TI in this matter. He's went to law school. He's very familiar with the legal process. There was no petition pending in the family court matter for him to be appointed. That issue went up on appeal. The Court of Appeals did not address the merits of that claim. The Court of Appeals, on a procedural ground, that is, it lacked jurisdiction, refused to address entertain or address the merits of the appeal. So any suggestion that somehow the Court of Appeals looked at this and addressed the merits of my client's claim is just simply not true. Dr. Weinstock made clear from the start of his appointment that he was essentially going to force the child and father together. There was no bonded relationship between father and child at the time. In fact, there still isn't. There was a pervasive history of domestic violence against mother and child and others. The child continued to suffer trauma, and there were serious questions as to father's fitness to parent. The father committed domestic violence against mother and children from the beginning of the relationship. He's had a long history of inability to empathize, which his own therapist recognized. Prior to the divorce decree, father bully intimidated mental health professionals involved in this matter to the point that each refused to participate at some point and resigned, all but for Dr. Elizabeth Doak. Father bullied, intimidated most professionals in this case afterwards, that is, after the decree. I helped mother obtain an order of protection against father to protect her and the child. After the court granted the order of protection, father engaged in outbursts in the court to such an extent that the court commented that he had proved the necessity for the order of protection and told father to leave the courtroom. Afterwards, father threatened me, my firm, and my client. My firm started providing security for my client, and we had security in our law firm. At trial before the family court, father bullied and intimidated the court itself. Never have I, in 30 plus years of trial practice, seen a judge wilt from the intimidation of a party. The court father victimized the court to the point that father was physically removed from the courtroom. Even so, my client's been open to father and child having a relationship if two things was best interest for the child and someone credible opined that father was fit to be the parent. My client was trusting mental health professionals to make those determinations. However, professionals continued to express concern about the child's ongoing trauma and father's fitness. Unfortunately, the facts were that father was allowed to choose his own therapist, who expressed a number of concerns about his fitness, including that he didn't appear to have the ability to empathize. Dr. Doak had questions about father's fitness as well. And the CFE by Dr. Schrockenstein expressed some concerns as well. Mother supported the Rule 69 agreement that you heard reference to, made a number of recommendations as to father's parenting time. I believe a credible review of the record reveals that Dr. Weinstock came into the case with the intent to force father and child together, despite the interests of the child and despite a number of facts. Dr. Weinstock did so despite no bonded relationship, despite a pervasive history of domestic violence, despite the opinions of others that the child continued to suffer trauma, despite concerns of the child's pace to have a relationship with father, and despite opinions of others that father may be unfit. Dr. Weinstock did so despite his own COBE materials, which say that if you don't have a fit parent or you have pervasive domestic violence, that process is not appropriate. For good reasons, Dr. Weinstock's opinions met resistance by others appointed in the case. However, rather than develop a factual basis for a safe, credible reunification in the best interest of the child, Dr. Weinstock embarked on a plan to change the reality of father being an abuser still having traumatic effect on the child to a false narrative of mother not cooperating with him. Even after mother explained in detail in an email to Dr. Weinstock on June 23rd, 2021, explaining how Dr. Weinstock's new narrative as to hers was baseless and in fact false, Dr. Weinstock maintained his position, expressing an intent to change custody from mother to father if mother did not perform as he directed, all beyond the parenting plan in place for which he was appointed to merely support, not change the plan by doing harm. An intentional false narrative is contrary to the TI appointment and the professional obligations at issue here. Eventually, as a mere TI, Dr. Weinstock replaced all the professionals in the case who disagreed with him. He then advanced a treatment plan in which he may have a vested pecuniary interest and about which he and father's counsel have presented to judges and attorneys. Indeed, in one recent case, a colleague of mine was told by a new judge on the family court bench, "We will be appointing Dr. Weinstock here, right?" To which my colleague said, "Absolutely not. I've been informed this morning of another case where the exact same thing happened with another judge." So it appears that Dr. Weinstock is priming judges to do what he wants despite credible opinions of others. In the end, you have a recent report by Dr. Anderson as to the child. That report opines that parenting time for father should be suspended. It explains that the child's brain structure was changed because of father's pervasive domestic violence, that the child has regressed with contact with father, and that she still suffers trauma. The false narrative created by Dr. Weinstock in this case has deeply and significantly harmed and damaged my client and her child. You have a factual and legal basis upon which to stop the continuing harm to them and to others. Finally, the record reveals without credible doubt Dr. Weinstock has a bias against my client. When other professionals pointed out his bias, Dr. Weinstock initiated an effort to have each of them removed from the case. Further, I'm not aware Dr. Weinstock has any specific training or expertise in child behavior, child development, or domestic violence, evoking questions of whether he practices outside his scope. In a recent deposition of father repeatedly claimed that what he did and how he acted was supported by and informed by Dr. Weinstock. We respectfully urge the committee to move this matter forward for additional consideration. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Board members, do you have any questions?
Not at this point.
I will start. How often did Dr. Weinstock meet with your child?
He actually only met with her twice. The first time was about a 10-minute visit, and the second time he was not meeting with her. She went to his office to have a Zoom call with father. So other than that initial 10-minute visit in December of 2020, he did not hold any sessions with her.
So during this whole period, you're saying that he met twice with the child, once a short meeting and then with a father Zoom.
With a Zoom, exactly.
Okay. And with the, in regards to the psychologists that were involved, as I recall, with you and with the child, Dr. Weinstock requested that they be taken off the case. Is that correct?
Correct.
And these are two licensed psychologists, is that correct?
They are.
And they had a significant amount of history with you and your child?
Yes. Dr. Doak has been seeing my child for 4 years. Ms. Nelson, I had been seeing her for 2.5 years. The other issue is I have sole legal custody. That Rule 69, that Dr. Malott, I appreciate your summary because I know there was a lot to review here. The Rule 69 is actually an agreement upon between the parties. The court does not, the court only issues that they agreed to. What they did, what our agreement was, is that we were going to use ATI, which was Donnelly Sarda. Ms. Vigil was the year before that. And before that, we had Dr. Akins. So after Donnelly Sarda resigned in 2020, she was our third TI who resigned because she could not get father to cooperate. And she actually wrote to the court that another TI would have the same outcome, and that in her belief, and this was after reviewing the custody evaluation, speaking with father's therapist, my therapist, and child's therapist, that father's behavior was going to continue to traumatize the child. Dr. Weinstock instituted parenting time anyways.
I just want to focus on the question. So
yes, I'm sorry.
Okay. So these two individuals, they were removed from the team
initially. Well, yes, I removed child from her provider, and then I started seeing another provider. Dr. Weinstock self-suspended shortly after that. Child had no provider. The provider that Dr. Weinstock had chosen was actually pregnant and was leaving for maternity leave. And the short period of time before maternity leave, she only worked a couple of days a week. So child saw her twice, and then we found out she was leaving. So child was with no therapist, so I had to take her back to Dr. Doak.
And also, did Dr. Weinstock provide any recommendations for other counselors?
No, he had given a short list to my attorney, and they were all former interns of his. Dr. Jamie Pikus, Dr. Corsten, there was two more that weren't available, and then one that wouldn't take the case, ironically, because Dr. Weinstock was involved.
All right, thank you. And I'm just looking at my notes. This is a big case. I'm sorry,
I'm really sorry.
Okay, so did at any time, there seems to be some accusations, if you could clarify Dr. Weinstock's reference or comments that if regarding giving the father full custody for some reasons, could you explain that? That seemed to be in the report a few times.
I'll try to without tearing up. As I mentioned, I have sole custody. This case had gone through roughly 3 years of litigation, and we've been to trial. The court has heard all of the evidence, and they determined I should have sole custody. And the custody evaluation also determined that I should have sole custody, and that father's behavior traumatized the child. So when Dr. Weinstock started, he immediately started saying that he was going to reunify. And my only question was, have you read the custody evaluation? Are you aware of father's fitness? And he said that it didn't matter. He was going to reunify. And after that, he told the provider team that if they didn't get me on board, he was going to recommend a reversal of custody, at which point the providers were shocked and questioned that, because TI doesn't have the authority to even change a parenting plan, much less make a recommendation of reversal of custody. After that, I never spoke to Dr. Weinstock. He never saw my child. He ignored all the reports of regression that were happening during parenting time. He actually spoke to father during a co-parenting session about father's anger in the session, and then within moments started planning an 8-hour visit between father and child. The supervised visit reports do show that the supervisor, and we've had several, has had to intervene because father is calling the child names or behaving inappropriately, threatening child, scaring child, telling him he's going to take her back to Massachusetts in a suitcase. So the family bridges would require the court to reverse custody. In addition to the providers, he's written emails to that same effect. So
So in the and I am not an attorney, so you have to forgive me for stumbling over some of this. In the court, the 69, you were in agreement with starting to unify with father.
Father and I agreed to use a TI, and it would have been our third TI. And we chose Donnelly Sarda. And the judge at that time had said, whatever this TI says, you guys have to do it. Well, we found out later she can't do that because I have sole legal. But we said, yes, that next TI, Donnelly Sarda, read the custody evaluation, interviewed all five mental health professionals. And she said, we've all come to the same opinion. Father is traumatizing child and his behaviors are continuing. So when the custody evaluation was done, the presumption was that he has rehabilitated. He wouldn't continue to behave that way. He very much is still behaving that way.
Were you in favor or not? Were you doing due diligence and trying to rectify or, you know, get the child with, you know, be able to develop that relationship?
Absolutely. A child and I moved here from Massachusetts when she was 1 year old. From that time until 2018, I think, when I had to get a protective order, I was accommodating every single visit father had. He came out here and insisted that I be present for the visits. And during the visits, he continued to engage in domestic violence. So I removed myself from the visits and he stopped doing parenting time. He didn't see the child for 3 years because he actually, it was Mr. Makuta that had sent letters asking him to schedule parenting time and he refused to do it. So once I removed myself, he wouldn't exercise parenting time. Even now, since Dr. Weinstock initiated parenting time, in the past 11 months, father has not exercised parenting time 3 of those months. And some of the months where I've tried to work with a schedule of 5 consecutive days for the CFE, he's only exercised 3 days.
So I just want to focus on, I'm trying to just focus on Dr. Weinstock's activities in this situation.
Understood.
Not necessarily. So Dr. Weinstock made a recommendation to the court regarding sending the child to Family Bridges. And it's my understanding Family Bridges is a unification camp where a child is sent away.
It's held by unlicensed professionals in hotel conference rooms. It is as controversial as you can get. Children go in. Dr. Weinstock said that he conferred with a Dr. Warshak about child. Neither of them had met child. And Family Bridges takes the child. There's no contact with the custodial parent. After the 4 days, then they have to do a 9-day vacation that's mandatory. Right prior to this recommendation, Dr. Weinstock had wrote the court that I should be responsible for the TI costs. So I would have paid for that $70,000 reunification.
All right. So Ms. Galvin, am I allowed to say the age of the child in an open meeting?
You may.
Okay. So this would have been a child of 7?
She was actually 6 and she was turning 7 that month. Yes.
All right. And what were the child has her own psychologist, your psychologist, what were their thoughts and recommendations regarding that?
She said that it would cause irreparable harm to the child. And since that time, I have cooperated with father's visitation each month. And since that time, child has had significant regression that's been found by 5 other professionals since Dr. Weinstock has his appointment expired.
All right, thank you. And again, I have notes and page numbers all over, so you got to forgive me. I'm just trying to make sure I can't understand. I think that's all my questions for right now. Other board members? All right, hearing none, thank you. We're going to then move, and if I'd like to introduce Dr. Weinstock, and I believe he's represented by is it Dr. Cohen?
It is, but we'll go with Larry Cohen today.
Larry Cohen. Okay. I can't remember it. If you could please introduce yourselves, and then if you'd like to make a brief statement to the board.
Thank you, Ms. Shreve. I can you hear me all right from where I am?
We can. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it. My name is Larry Cohen. I'm counsel for Dr. Weinstock, who is seated to my right. Dr. Weinstock is here and available. Ms. Shreve, I planned a opening statement to cover a number of issues, but in light of your questions, I'd like to focus on that for a bit. I do have some comments about Mr. Makuta's statement that I'll make as well. I timed him at about 9 minutes. I'll try to stay within that time frame, but forgive me if I run over. I do want to cover quickly the issues you've raised. I know Dr. Weinstock does it well. Let me start with meetings with the child. And let me just say, Ms. Shreve and committee members, I covered all of this in 50 single-spaced pages of material to try and be very comprehensive and address all of these issues. And I know that all committee members work very hard, and I'm sure you've read everything. With regard to visitation, Dr. Weinstock tried to have more visits. He did have the one he was able to do. He tried to schedule another where father and child would be in the office. Mother redirected that to the park. Finally, as part of his effort to increase the number of times he could see the child, he had a meeting with the attorneys who became appointed in early June. One of the agreements was that he would have sessions with the child, a number of them. I think there were 6 sessions to be scheduled, so that he had the opportunity to interact with the child. Shortly thereafter, mother's attorney filed a motion to claiming that his appointment was illegal, and so he self-suspended during that time out of respect for the legal issue that was raised. As far as providers off the case, that's not entirely accurate. He was very concerned after months of, after having reviewed the comprehensive family evaluation, which also addressed the issue of the provider's involvement and commitment to reunification. Dr. Weinstock proposed not having the child with no providers or mother with no provider, but proposed bringing in forensically informed providers who could deal with the forensic issues presented involving trauma to the child. Mother proposed, and he agreed, that both of the providers, Dr. Doak and Ms. Nelson, would remain in the case, and they did remain involved. They were both treating child at the same time. Dr. Weinstock was supportive of that, and they did stay involved. Any suggestion otherwise is simply not accurate. As far as Ms. Dr. Corston is concerned, as part of the supplement, I provided you with a report from Dr. Corston that talked about her concerns about mother's alienation, talked about her concerns about why the child was having difficulty. She was, again, selected from a list of providers provided to mother by Dr. Weinstock. The list was not exclusive. Mother was welcome to go out and find someone else, but he did provide a list. The list remained. Not everyone on the list had been professionally involved with him. They were not all interns. As far as the idea that he recommended a reversal of custody, you will find that nowhere in the many letters that he wrote to the court. You did receive, and in fact, you got it from Mr. Makuta, a copy of an email message in which this issue of reversal of custody came up. And he had a meeting with the providers at that time. This was in May of 2021. Dr. Doak was concerned that she interpreted Dr. Weinstock as suggesting or saying he was going to make a recommendation for reversal of custody. He wrote back to her in a message that's dated May 15, 2021 at 12:58 p.m. and said, "You've misunderstood what I said." The entirety of what he said in there is there. What he was doing was explaining to everyone the importance of everyone getting on board, trying to help this child become comfortable, trying to work with mother to become comfortable, and trying to move ahead with the court, with the reunification that the court ordered, not Dr. Weinstock, but the court ordered. And in this message, let me read to you, Ms. Shreve, what was said, because it's the opposite of what mother just told you. He said, "I agree with you," speaking to Dr. Doak. "I agree with you that a custody reversal would be severe and should be avoided." He never made a recommendation in any of the letters he wrote to the court, and he never recommended it. He simply said that, you know, if mother and child could not move forward, one of the things he has seen courts do is reverse custody. He wanted to work not to have that happen, and he never made that recommendation. Suggesting otherwise, that's been done repeatedly, is frankly outrageous. As far as family bridges, it is a recognized program. It's used to deal with reunification. But keep in mind, again, this was a recommendation of the court. SN and father were both represented at the time. They both received a copy of his recommendation. They both had an opportunity to ask the court to be heard. They both had an opportunity to provide evidence. It was up to the court to make that decision, not Dr. Weinstock. Contrary to what's being suggested to you by SN and her attorney, Dr. Weinstock did not impose anything. Dr. Weinstock made recommendations to the court. He made them based on what he was observing. He based them on based on Dr. Schreckenstein's 137-page family court evaluation, in which she raised almost all of the issues that are coming up here are addressed in there. The idea that mother was alienating, the idea that the providers were not supportive, the idea that there were challenges in reunification because mother did not support it. In my material, Dr. Vigil quoted mother as saying that she started out supporting therapeutic intervention because she thought it would fail and it would prove that, that this could not occur. Mother said that to Dr. Vigil. That was in Dr. Schreckenstein's report. The idea that, that Dr. Weinstock was not working is completely belied by the file that you received. You had the email messages in which you worked with providers to try to get them on board. And in fact, they were on board. He worked with the attorneys when they became involved. The file is replete with all the efforts he made to do one thing. And what was the one thing? He was appointed by the court. The court was his client. He was appointed by the court to achieve reunification. That was recommended by Dr. Schreckenstein after reviewing everything you've heard today about the father's history, after doing everything that you've seen today or heard today about all the issues that went on, the issues with the court, the issues with father's behavior. All of that was discussed by Dr. Schreckenstein. And at the end, she made a recommendation that reunification go forward. The court said that it reviewed everything. The court had the opportunity to hear from parents, and the court decided, and the parties entered into a Rule 69 agreement to have reunification. That agreement is the court's order appointing Dr. Weinstock is Exhibit 1. It gave him the authority to do every single thing that he did, and he could have done it unilaterally. But instead, he worked with everyone to try and move this forward. He made recommendations to the court. He didn't do anything that's being described as imposing here. He made recommendations, and the court either approved them or didn't, and the parties all had an opportunity to go there. Let me address a few things that Mr. Makuta brought up that are concerning. First, in his materials, Mr. Makuta goes back and talks about, and he talked about it again today, about Annette Burns and how she and Dr. Weinstock were aligned. Father went to Annette Burns months before Dr. Weinstock was appointed and talked with her about representing him. Notwithstanding that, Ms. Burns didn't get involved as counsel until early June, along at the same time that mother got counsel. The first thing the two of them did was have a meeting with Dr. Weinstock and entered into an agreement to move forward in all the ways that Dr. Weinstock recommended, every single one of them, bringing in new providers to provide forensically informed help, Dr. Weinstock getting more time. Everything is in that June 2nd document. And the attorneys representing mother and representing father both agreed to that. But my bigger point about Ms. Burns is that by the time she became involved, Dr. Weinstock, about 3 weeks later, self-suspended and was hardly involved after that. He was involved for short pieces of time, but not very much involved. There was no connection here. And the suggestion that there was otherwise is frankly character assassination. Speaking of character assassination, for Mr. Makuta to come in front of you and bring in this gossip and bring in this thing that he thinks he's went on makes him a witness. And he knows that under our ethical rules, he shouldn't be both representing someone acting as a witness. This committee doesn't hear witness testimony, but Mr. Makuta has just made himself a witness by all these things that he said, which are gossip and not substantiated and not before you on this matter. Mr. Makuta made in his letter to the board in which he identified himself, made an accusation that he repeated today that suggested that somehow we had told the board that the question of Dr. Weinstock's appointment had been addressed substantively. Never happened. On page 4, footnote 7, in the response, we specifically said that the court resolved the issue on appeal on procedural grounds, and we gave you a copy of the order. His suggestion otherwise, again, I don't know where this is coming from. I'm not sure that Mr. Makuta may have read it. Never mind. I won't go there. I'm sorry. It's just very distressing to see this kind of character assassination. Appreciate that Mr. Makuta has very strong feelings, but those are his strong feelings about father. A few other things. I won't go over all the things that I covered in the response and in the supplement. There are mistakes or misstatements in mother's timeline. I don't have time to go through them. I'm already beyond what I should be using, and I respect that. But you have to look carefully at what mother claimed her factual statements. She said as the first item in her factual statement that Farron Akins was appointed as a TI by the court and left in context of conflict with father. If you go back and look at the court record, which I appreciate you don't have access to, but we do for that, Dr. Akins was appointed as a family court evaluator, and he left the case because he said he had too many other obligations. So again, you need to go through and look at the facts. I spent an enormous amount of time going through each and every issue here and setting the record straight. I provided loads of documents to support it. And I would urge the committee to appreciate that Dr. Weinstock was appointed by the court to accomplish something that the court decided it would do after reading a 137-page evaluation that covered everything that's being discussed here about the father's history. He made the appointment in the context of the family agreeing there would be a therapeutic interventionist. He imposed authority and responsibilities that Dr. Weinstock didn't even use, but rather tried to work with everyone and go forward from there. He did what he was asked to do. He was attentive to the child's interest. Let me just make one comment on that real quick. When he interacted with Dr. Dope to find out what was going on with the child as they moved forward. For example, between him, one, he provided for Dr. Dope to see the child, to see how the child was doing between visits with the father at the beginning. He had a professional supervisor watching to see what went on during the supervision. Read the supervision notes that you were provided. Not one of them is there any indication of the father engaging in violence. The father was seeing Dr. Pat Brady for therapy. Dr. Weinstock was in touch with her about how father was doing going forward. He was very attentive to what was happening with the child, but he was also aware that he had a responsibility that, based upon what the court decided, to go forward. The history of violence that Mr. Makuda talks about was addressed by the court, not by Dr. Weinstock. The court appointed him. It was the court's decision. It wasn't Dr. Weinstock's place to come in and be an attorney and say, "Judge, you can't appoint me." He was appointed, and he acted on that appointment. I'm sorry. I know I've gone on. I apologize for taking your time, but it's so important to get the record straight, and I went to such great length to try to set an accurate record. Thank you for your time.
All right.
Dr. Weinstock is available to answer questions.
All right. Thank you very much. Board members, do you have any questions?
Yes, I do have some questions. I also just want to make a quick disclaimer. Dr. Weinstock does teach occasionally for NAU, but I have no direct contact or any relationship with him. So I just wanted to make that for the record. My questions are for Dr. Weinstock. In terms of the accusation that was in the record by the complainant, the whole reversal of custody, I appreciate Mr. Cohen pointing out, the custody reunification. Courts may sometimes move to custody reversal if we cannot move forward with a reunification plan. Besides the example that Mr. Cohen brought up, were there other instances where that statement could have been made?
I have no recollection of ever suggesting that I was going to be recommending reversal of custody. I believe I consistently identified that that was a risk that the court might order if we did not accomplish the goals. And I saw it, as Mr. Cohen said, to avoid any discussion of reversal of custody. I think that was very clear in conversations with the providers. And I believe the notes that you have about my provider calls speak to that. And certainly as the email identified earlier, I made it very clear that was not my intent or goal. I sought to avoid that.
Okay. So when you first went in, when you were appointed to assist with the Rule 69 objectives and reunification, what were some of your goals and objectives that you had? Reunification is a broad term. Do you mind sharing that?
Sure. And I apologize. I don't believe I have the letter in front of me, but early in the process, I identify a very detailed treatment plan, essentially. Within that treatment plan, what comes to mind are a few goals. One is for father and emotional regulation. And again, this is in a letter to the court. Number two is mom learning to support the process in dad's contact. And three, where there was a goal towards co-parenting and communication, trying to work with parents and focus with parents on working together for the purpose of reunification. That is a typical goal, quite honestly, of reunification. I often will start the work trying to create a foundation of parents working together, but at the same time, checking in on those other goals in terms of dad's emotional regulation or mom's support of the process. Those goals are in line with what we would call hypothesis testing. And I think I outlined different hypotheses to the court as well. And you'll see that in the letters. And I talked about hypotheses, including this child, if regressing, is responding to dad currently in terms of dad behaviors. I considered the hypothesis of the child responding to past concerns in terms of past observations from when she was 3 years old. I considered the possibility of mom alienating, as Dr. Schreckenstein referenced. I considered the hypothesis that even her own therapist, Ms. Nelson, talked about, and you'll see this in notes from provider calls. There's reference to it in the letters. Ms. Nelson identified concern as well about mom being so anxious that it trickles to the child, and that the child might be reacting to mom's anxiety. All of those hypotheses underline the treatment goals that I talked about in that letter to the court.
Thank you. So I had one question. When there were supervised visitations, and when you read the notes by the monitor, the person who observed, what was your conclusion based on those observations of the visitation between the father and the daughter?
That's a real important question. First of all, I want to point out that my recollection is there were multiple supervisors. Ms. Boxer was a supervisor prior to me, and that Ms. Porter was a supervisor during my tenure. My interpretation was that father is acting appropriately. So we go back to those hypotheses about the child reacting to father's current behaviors, and I didn't see evidence of that. I also note that I didn't see evidence in the time I did see father and child together in my office. In terms of other observations of the supervision notes, I communicated with Dr. Corston as well, who had been seeing the child. I actually think she identified four sessions with the child. She reviewed the notes as well. And she and I collaborated and agreed that the notes, the supervision notes, were supported more of a concern of the child reacting to mom potentially than dad. That dad was not doing anything of concern for the supervision notes, which I believe you have, but the child was reacting. And the child was saying inappropriate things to the father, for example. So she had a working hypothesis, Dr. Corston, before mom stopped taking the child to her. Her working hypothesis, as she identified and emailed to the attorneys, was that this was about mom's behavior and the child responding to it.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Weinstein.
Thank you, Dr. Davis-Wilson. All right. I have some questions. So can you remind me again, when did you submit your request to the court to remove yourself from this roughly?
I think it was in June of 2021.
June 21.
It was soon after I received notice from mom's attorney questioning my thought.
All right. So you started seeing the clients in, it looks like, about December of 20?
Correct.
And how many times did you meet with the child?
Mom is correct. I only met with her on two occasions, but I want to point out that was not my process. I sought to meet with her on more occasions, and I think that's clearly evidenced in my letters to the court. But what happened one day, we had a plan, and this, I want to emphasize, was endorsed by all of the providers, including Dr. Doak and Ms. Nelson. I had a provider call who developed a plan. The plan included me meeting with father and the child in my office for a session And they were going to work on a photo album. They were going to bring pictures and work on a photo album to try to reframe essentially their relationship into better times, times that they had as when she was a little kid, to help her reframe what dad was. The intent, by the way, was to have that session. And Dr. Doak was going to meet with her in between that and the next session where the child was supposed to come. What happened the day of the session that was planned was mom sent an email and identified that she had made a plan to have dad meet with a child in a park with a babysitter supervisor. I emphasized, dad did not agree with this. What he said to me specifically was, I just wanted to see my daughter. My preference would have been to follow the plan and have a meeting in your set, in your office, but this is what mom wanted and this is what I agreed to do. I never had the opportunity to see the child again in my office. And what we did is we altered the plan, including with the providers, to start supervised visits out of the office because I couldn't meet with the child in the office. I emphasize, by the way, referencing Dr. Schreckenstein's report, I was trying to focus on what she recommended for phase one with having multiple sessions in my office with child and father. I couldn't do it. And it went to phase two, not by my choice, but essentially by mom, who wanted to have the supervised visits out of the office.
So if we, thanks for, maybe I just pushed the wrong button here. So in regards to, let me find the report real quick. So in you mentioned Dr. Schreckenstein's report. And for those of you that are, I'm looking at the investigation file, page six, in mine it's 644, line 15. In her report, it says it's, anyways, it goes on to say that the evaluator must develop a relationship with the child so that she feels comfortable and secure in the interventionist's office and able to vocalize her thoughts and feelings and in an age-appropriate way. It's important that this relationship be established before discussions of father are introduced in sessions with the child. Once the child is able to tolerate discussions of father, child will likely need indirect contact with father in multiple ways, such letters, videos, gifts, etc., to help facilitate her comfort in discussing father. Can you explain what exactly you did in order to follow those instructions?
Sure. I referenced the February 4th letter that I wrote to the court, the report to the court, on page one. And I was trying to collaborate with the providers to figure out the best plan. Dr. Doak noted that child had a visit with a therapeutic interventionist. There was no regression following the visit. Mother states that the child knew the meeting was about seeing her father. She did not progress. That was the first step. When I talked to the providers, we agreed to utilize Dr. Doak to be the one, since she had a long-term relationship with the child, to be that secure base, if you will. And that's why we developed a plan to integrate her seeing the child while I had the child with father, integrating the two types of sessions. We as a team agreed that was the best approach. It didn't make a lot of sense to me to try to make, to develop this therapeutic relationship with the child when she already had the therapeutic relationship with Dr. Doak. So we attempted to integrate that therapeutic relationship to affect what I felt would be the least detrimental process for the child. And I think it was a good plan, but we couldn't follow it.
Okay, so the agreement was then to use Dr. Doak, who's a psychologist. However, you then eventually requested that she and Dr. Nelson be removed as part of the team. And why was that?
And I want to emphasize, being part of the team is different than being removed. As Mr. Cohen mentioned, I very, very clearly said, mom can continue with Ms. Nelson, child can continue with Dr. Doak. The problem I discovered as I progressed is the focus for those two providers was on the single hypothesis that this child, if she regresses, is because of dad's behavior. And I felt that they were not considering multiple hypotheses, which I think is necessary in a forensic case like this. So what I asked is for mother to see an additional provider if she wished. She could continue with Ms. Nelson if she wanted to. For mom to see an additional provider, and for the child to see an additional provider, where they focused on the reunification and what mom or this child needed, again, focusing on those multiple hypotheses. And that's why I sought someone who I believe could be more objective and focus on those hypotheses than what I had experienced at that point from Drs. Doak and Nelson. I emphasize, as Mr. Cohen pointed out, my experience with those two providers was exactly the same as Ms. Vigil's experience before me and Dr. Schreckenstein's report, where she identified the same concerns about how they weren't considering those multiple hypotheses and questioned whether they can effectively be part of it.
So if that was your thought, that they are going to, their behavior would be the same as before, then why didn't you take on the role of the interventionist being actively involved with the child, if you weren't going to take their recommendations?
I did. And as I mentioned, I just identified that Dr. Doak and I continued with those providers. I accepted that they were still on the case and they could work as positive attributes to the team. And it wasn't until months later that I realized it's not going to work. This isn't going to be effective because I didn't find that they were supporting the process and concerns of the multiple hypotheses.
Yatrid, may I point to you and something in the materials that specifically answers your question?
Sure.
The effort to the involvement of Dr. Doak in terms of in between sessions and working with the child, that was in the early months of the therapeutic intervention between December and March. As time went on and Dr. Weinstock came to feel that he needed to involve other providers, he shifted in the sense that when we had the June 2 meeting with the attorneys and the agreement was reached on how they would proceed, it was provided in there that Dr. Weinstock would then have the 6 or 7 sessions specifically with the child to now shift the plan so that he was now working with the child directly while forensically involved providers came in place. So the plan that the team developed with Dr. Doak was not working. So we provided to bring in different advisors and to go back to what Dr. Schreckenstein had suggested, which is now for him to be seeing the child and develop a therapeutic relationship. If you look at the June 2 document, and I'll have to look up the exhibit number, it specifically provides for exactly what you're saying in there. The transition from one approach that wasn't working to another approach, again, more involved with Dr. Schreckenstein's report, where he would be seeing the child because Dr. Doak is not going to be playing that role any longer. That's in the June 2 memorandum.
I think it's June, if I may, it's a June 16th report to the court, which represented a June 2nd conversation with the attorneys. And if I may, very clearly on page 1, the agreement with the attorneys was scheduled and consistent supervised visits, child participating with the new therapist, mother participating with the new therapist, father continuing with Ms. Brady, his therapist, every other week, TI co-parenting sessions, the idea, again, laying the foundation of co-parenting cooperation, every other week, check-in sessions with the TI, the child, and father, with the possibility of minimizing or eliminating the check-ins as the child's therapist progresses in her treatment, which again is a reflection of, I thought it important the child have a therapeutic relationship with the therapist while at the same time trying to integrate myself into some sort of relationship with the child that she needs with her father. And it was a good plan, but as you can see by the session dates that I have one co-parenting session after that, and that was it.
Then just, I also want to address, there was an email, it's on page 135 of the investigative report from Dr. Georgia Nelson, and it's regarding her providing you feedback, saying that mom's totally accepted, father is going to have parenting time with the child and has been supporting and preparing to do it successfully. Child has actually been engaging in significant regression. Despite this, mom is accepting the visits and helping her daughter by being positive and encouraging and comforting when they engage in a regressive behavior. Then it goes on to say, however, mom's been experiencing some fair amount of stress and other issues. This has resulted in her in regards to how she perceives her relationship with you. This has resulted in her engaging in an avoidant behavior in regards to co-parenting session. I'm very concerned that this is affecting her mental health and a sense of well-being. Goes on to say that the majority of emails when it involves mom are negative and condescending and seem to minimize her concerns and emotions. I do believe that there is a negative, harmful attitude toward her and it is impacting her mental health and stress level. Goes on to say during a Zoom call, Dr. Dorca raised the same issue about how you might improve your relationship with mom. The response was very concerning. You stated, and it says, quotes, she doesn't want me to succeed, but unquote. Quite frankly, I was shocked at the statement. It raises concerns about your ability to serve both parents equally and objectively. The suggestion you made about reversing custody came across as punitive toward the mom, which seems unnecessary in light of the fact that there is a noted regression with the child and visits are happening. I also believe that if that were to happen, this would further traumatize the family. I thought our goal was to do what's best interest of the child. That being said, I want to reiterate that mom is on board with dad visiting and working with dad to make this happen. Basically it's a, you know, closing paragraph. That's sent to you at 7:38 p.m. on May 18th. You respond on May 18th at 10 o'clock to both psychologists, says George and Elizabeth. Over the past week, you both sent me emails expressing concerns about my approach with this family. Given your expressed concerns and our divergent opinions about this case and the dynamics, I do not believe we can have a coordinated team approach that will effectively assist this family as anticipated by the court. As such, I will write to the court and request intervention. So can you explain when a psychologist, a licensed psychologist, raises their concerns, who's been involved in the case, your response is, well, you're not part of the team.
Ms. Shreve, do you mind referencing the page number again?
Yeah, it's on page, the first email is on page 135. The second response email is on page 134. So I'm just trying to get a flavor here. What you have is differing, obviously, opinions, and that's what you're going to get. I mean, probably through attorneys and through psychologists. But she voices opinions, she voices concerns about your relations, or you know, how the mother feels about how you're reacting to her, and your response is, well, I'm not interested, or you know, can you explain your response?
Sure. I appreciate that, and you're right, this is the complexity of a case like this. There are different providers who have different perspectives, and as I noted earlier, I believed we needed to test multiple hypotheses. What is causing reactivity for mom or the child? And while Dr. Doak and Ms. Nelson have their perspectives, as I identified earlier, I had concern that their perspectives was focused only on dad as a perpetrator, as the causation for the dynamics we've seen. I emphasized that was endorsed by Ms. Vigil and Dr. Schreckenstein, who were both appointed by the court. So I had to, as you describe, weigh different perspectives about the dynamics in the family. And my conclusion was, for me to succeed in the court's role, I believe we needed different providers to be supportive of the process and consider those different hypotheses, something I didn't feel that they were doing at that point. And apparently Dr. Schreckenstein had not agreed that we would do it. And that's why there is, as you say, a difference of opinion. I appreciate a clinical decision about what the best way to proceed is. I believe I had balanced all of the considerations. I emphasized the words I used in the email. I didn't see us being able to collaborate as a team because they considered that one hypothesis when I thought there were other hypotheses in play. And that's why I didn't think we would succeed as a team. And why I ultimately, at that late date, quite honestly, because that's towards the end of my involvement That's when I had suggested different providers.
So do you believe was there domestic violence involved in this case? Is there a history of it?
Absolutely. I think I identified that from the beginning. If you read my letters to the court, I acknowledged it. The question for me, though, after, as Mr. Cohn said, the court had already appointed me with knowledge of those concerns of domestic violence, had reviewed Dr. Schreckenstein's report outlining that violence, yet still appointed me to remand. So for me, the question is, do I see evidence of domestic violence during my tenure that would suggest I should stop the process? I didn't. As I described, the supervised visits were evidence to me that father was able to regulate. Besides Ms. Brady, who was working on a consistent basis with father, I believe over 30 sessions, or 40 sessions, even by the time I was involved, she identified that her client had significantly improved. I observed father in my office, and he was regulated during my sessions. Did he and mother both at times get emotional and reactive to each other? Yes, they did. But it was not to the point where I considered it a form of domestic violence as much as what I typically see in a family court conflict. So I absolutely considered domestic violence as a concern. And I want to emphasize that I recall even a case I had a few years ago where I was doing reunification. I had allegations of domestic violence. I had a dad who I did not think had the insight. And in that case, I stopped my case. I stopped reunification and told the court, I don't think it's appropriate. The point of the story is I'm willing to stop if I see evidence of behaviors that create that concern. I didn't see it.
All right. So I want to ask you, I've got a question for you then. On page 296, one second, there is a deposition of the father. And I just want to ask you about his response to a question. Let me see, 296.
297, actually. That's where that text comes on DB.
One second. A lot of pages in this, so I'm sorry about that.
I understand.
Make sure I got this. All right. And I'm just trying to be thorough, so I make sure I have all the different things. So this is a deposition of the father. I don't remember it was taken. I think it was recently, but like a month or so ago. And so I'm going to start on, because it mentioned you. So I want to get your thought on this. So it says, this is on page 295, Mike 295. Is this thing, if you're looking at the deposition, it's page 29. It starts on line 19-ish. And Ms. Ansel, who I think is the mother's attorney, right. Question, do you recognize this as a text between told by multiple therapists that the domestic violence claim are, and she uses the word BS, says it, and you say that it is a direct quote from Ms. Brady, and he answers yes. Okay, so Pat Brady, your therapist, would testify that she said that to you, correct? Ms. Byrne says objection. Witness says, I don't know if she would testify, but it'd probably be hearsay. Ms. Byrne says, don't guess, objection. Ms. Ansel says, would, and that's something that she said to you? Yes. Answers yes. Okay. Who are the multiple therapists saying that the domestic violence claims are BS? He answers, I'd rather not say. She says, okay. Well, you put it out there, so tell me who the providers are. Answer, no. Question, are there no providers? Why are you staring at me? It's part of the question, what she's saying. His answer, I'm waiting for you to ask another question. Question, the question is, who are the multiple therapists saying that the domestic violence claims are BS? And it's, she says the word. He says, answer is, I don't know. Ms. Burns, if you know the answer, you need to answer. Witness, what's that? Ms. Burns, if you know the answer, an answer to that question, you need to answer. Witness says, Weinstock said the domestic violence is BS. He says the word. And then parentheses, if anything, the father's a victim of the domestic violence. Ms. Ansel. Okay, so you're saying that Dr. Weinstock, Stock said that you were the victim of domestic violence. Answer, yes, that's what he told Pat Brady. Question, okay, who else? You said multiple therapists. Answer, it's a text. I can't remember. I didn't cite the text. Well, Pat Brady, question, anybody else? That's all I can remember at this point. And then it goes on another topic. So he, in his deposition, is stating that you have stated to his therapist that the domestic violence is BS, whatever you want to explain that as. Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, and I ask that you consider the context of this high conflict divorce where he is blaming the mother for not seeing the child.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you. If you could speak up a little bit.
Sorry. I ask that you consider the context of the deposition in a high conflict divorce where he's angry about not having seen the child. Those are his words, his choice of words. I have no doubt. I have never said to his therapist that he was not a perpetrator. I have not said that he was the victim and mom wasn't. I have not ever, ever said anything like that. I've identified in reports to the court that there is a foundation of domestic violence here. And as I said earlier, and this is, I suspect, what he misinterpreted, my focus is not on the past domestic violence. My focus is on what's occurring today. The court has ordered this process with knowledge of that past domestic violence. And my role only was to ensure it wasn't occurring. Again, the goal of him and emotion regulation. I point out, by the way, if I really believed that he wasn't a perpetrator, why would that be a treatment goal that I put in my first letters to the court? So I can't tell you what dad was thinking. I can identify suspicion of why he said it because it serves his court purpose. But I know without a doubt, I have not identified that he did not commit domestic violence.
What you're saying is if Dr. Brady were to be contacted, she would also state that?
I would expect her to, and I know she saw him for over 40 sessions for the purpose of helping him to learn to regulate his emotions. In fact, Ms. Brady and I vividly remember the conversations, how she herself identified that he was a perpetrator. And as I mentioned earlier, she herself said, Dr. Weinstock, he has improved dramatically since I first started. Okay. So that was her perspective. If she is saying that she didn't believe it was domestic violence, why would she see him for 40 sessions and claim to me that he had improved?
All right. Just one other track of questions. Your recommendation that the child go to the, I'm looking for the word.
Family Bridges.
The what?
Family Bridges program. Yeah,
Family Bridges program. There was a doctor, her psychologist was adamantly against it, saying that it could cause irreparable harm. She's 7 years old. From what I've read, I mean, never been away from parents or whatnot. What child psychologist or what recommendation or how did you assess the impact on this child and that if you were to send her to something like that for 4 to 9 days?
I appreciate that. And I also understand that this is a very special niche of practice in terms of the dynamics that occur in cases like this. And the Family Bridges is a well-known, I agree with what was said earlier, controversial program. And they essentially assess the family to identify appropriateness. And they consider different hypotheses besides the one, as I said, that has been focused on, which is domestic violence by father. Their focus is more on hypotheses that either the mother or line parent is being anxious and that's impacting the child's ability to develop that bond with the other parent, the estranged parent, or that it is alienation as mom intentionally is disrupting the bond. Quite honestly, if I had to guess a primary hypothesis, it's probably the first one. There is no question. And even Ms. Nelson identified over and over again that mom had a lot. Mom was having difficulty containing that anxiety.
Excuse me to interrupt you, but I, I appreciate those comments. I want to focus on the child.
Okay.
I want to focus on your decision making and how did you, you have a psychologist saying to her child psychologist saying this would be harmful. What is your background? The child is from trauma. I'm just trying to understand how, what method, what documentation, what theory did you assess to know the impact on this child if you were to send her to that?
Well, and I also want to point out in terms of the child that Dr. Corsten had been seeing the child and she supported a camp like Family Bridges. What did I do? I considered all of the data from the
professors. That's your background.
Oh, my personal background? Is that what you're asking?
Well, I'm just asking, I mean, that's a bit, to me, a big decision. You send a, so how did you know, or what did you assess the impact on the child, given the child's background of having trauma and whatever, you know, all the issues?
Sure. I considered the different hypotheses as to why the child was reacting the way she did. And I believed the primary hypothesis of giving the child some separation from father at this four-day camp would allow the child to develop that relationship. As even Dr. Doak said, when the child met with me and father, things went okay. She didn't regress. I believe we can get a much more objective perspective on the child's ability to develop that bond with father and see if she's truly regressing when observed by other people.
Dr. Shreve, that'd be your background in these kinds of issues working with children.
And just before you answer that, did you say, because I'm not familiar with this camp, so I just want to make sure. Did you just say that then father would be with her at the camp?
Yes, it's, the child doesn't go alone.
Okay, that was not, okay, that's when I'm asking, okay.
Oh, okay, I did hear that earlier that the child is sent away to camp. That's not what happened. Usually it's the estranged parent and the child spend significant time together with these professionals who have been doing this. I've known their work for over 20 years, and they help redevelop that relationship. And it's kind of in a vacuum to allow them to do it without concern about those other hypotheses, about things like the child reacting to mom. Yeah.
All right.
And in terms of my background, as I said, I've been doing this for 20 years. I've been involved with Family Bridges and other cases, as have most providers who do this kind of work. What I've seen is great success with that camp, that it really does help stabilize the family. And I emphasize that in terms of the impact on the child, you have to look no further than the record. This has been a destabilized family for years. And my hope was to stabilize the family. That's my main goal. And I believe that something like that program would assist in the stabilization.
All right. Thank you. Those are all my questions. Thank you. Other committee members, any further questions? All right. Hearing none, I'd like to thank you both for being with us today. At this point, are there any further questions for the complainant? There's just a lot of information. All right, hearing none, we'll go into deliberations. This is a time where the committee deliberates amongst themselves in regards to the case. Dr. Malott, you're the lead on the case. Would you like to start the deliberations?
Yes, thank you, Ms. Shreve. I appreciate all the detailed questions you asked as well. And I kind of, you know, as I reviewed the case and all of the different interventions that were done, the different therapists that were involved, the different recommendations that were made, I believe every, you know, all of these different recommendations are all coming from a place of where they're trying to help a very, very difficult situation. They're trying to help the child, help the parents, and kind of address the court order that was reunification. Reunification is challenging, especially when you have all the parties and you have so many opposing views. You know, there was conversation on the speed of reunification. 1 year, you know, there was a 1 year timeline provided with, you know, they would have to report back on how did the reunification proceed. The 134-page report by Dr. Schottenstein speaks about all of, you know, it was a very, very detailed history of what has gone on right from the start. And then again, ending with a recommendation that reunification tried. I think Dr. Weinstock tried many, many different techniques. He had many hypotheses. He was checking it out. He was trying to get the information, taking into consideration multiple provider views and moving forward in kind of a very systematic manner. You know, he had lots of information at his disposal. He attempted to meet with the child. He didn't have as many meetings as he would have liked. There were many circumstances. There's a long email on why each session was canceled or rescheduled. And at some point he, you know, took it to the court saying, what do you want me to do? You know, did he operate outside? You know, so there's several issues that rise to the surface. You know, was he focusing on reunification? My answer would be yes. Is it challenging? Yes. The one question that stood out to me was changing of custody. That was discussed, and then he explained it to the provider in terms of the his 20-year experience of whether custody can be reversed. And he said, we should avoid that at all purposes. And that's why we need to work very explicitly on reunification. You know, there was definitely providers with very, very different views on the case. We heard from the mother, and we heard from her attorney as well on kind of this long history of domestic violence. In a case like this, when you think of all the different things that are going on, you know, and you go back to our statutes, and did Dr. Weinstock, and that is our ultimate determination, did Dr. Weinstock violate our statute? Did he provide care that was below the standard of care? And that's what I'm struggling with this case. It's very complicated. There's many, many different issues, and everything has been done in a spirit of, okay, let's try this, let's try that. That doesn't seem to be working. How about family bridges can? But all going back to address the question of reunification, and is that possible? And a very thorough report by a psychologist saying this, you know, we really need to work on reunification. Not everyone agreed with that, but they all agreed to the plan that they would work on it. But then there was a lot of things happening that interfered with the plan. So I am having a hard time seeing how did it fall, and maybe you can help me, Ms. Sharif. You know, how did it fall below the standard of care? You know, when we've seen cases that have fallen below the standard of care, people have deliberately either failed to see the client, not addressed the information that was provided to them. And that's the part I'm struggling with. You know, here we have an expert who's worked for 20 years, who is got a lot of experience and is using that knowledge and experience to the best of his ability in a very, very difficult situation. And so I'll stop at that point for right now.
All right. Dr. Davis-Wilson, you want to make any comments? Do you want me to go first, or?
It makes no difference to me either way, whichever you prefer.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm kind of the mindset of Dr. Malat as well. I think that there's a lot of thorough information that has been provided as far as the records and ultimately the Rule 69 agreement to try reunification. I do find, you know, it's challenging sometimes as a professional when trying to make recommendations because a lot of the, you know, services that are provided are not a one size fits all. And so I think simply making a recommendation to utilize another program isn't necessarily a violation of any statute. To the contrary, I think in many cases we are expected to, when we're not seeing results or the expected results at the rate that we think. Am I having internet issues?
Yeah, there you go. Much better.
All right, let's see if it's better. What I was saying is that I think even to the issue of recommending another program, one of the things that sometimes we have to do as professionals is you look at, with all of the circumstances, what additional supports are available. Now, whether or not someone decides to utilize those supports, you know, oftentimes can be independent of what we recommend. And that doesn't necessarily mean anything negative. So I think that at least and I'm a behavior analyst, so I'm not a psychologist, you know, in the work that we do, when we aren't seeing the progression, it's not unusual for us to make other recommendations, to still have the end goal of, hey, we are trying to remediate or provide this unification goals or meet these goals, but it's not working. And so here are some other avenues to try. I don't know that that is representative of neglectful, unless of course, I think Ms. Shreve, you do bring up some good points of were there other considerations, but in review of the documentation, I mean, the supervised visits with Dad appeared to be, you know, going well. I think that there's a lot to this that obviously is very difficult for all parties, and we aren't privy to all of the details. But I too am struggling with, when compared to the statutes, which statutory requirements or which, you know, which statutes would apply here, is I'm not seeing violation of the statutes. The attempts to coordinate care are there, the very thorough documentation is there. You know, sometimes things aren't a fit, people aren't a fit, opinions aren't a fit, perspectives aren't a fit, but that doesn't necessarily to me equate to a statutory violation.
All right, thank you. Really great comments. I think if I have any concerns, it's the concern of the lack of interaction with the child, in the sense that that's what was suggested by the doctor. I wrote it down. And then the two psychologists that were working with mother and child were basically, when they raised concerns and concerns about Dr. Weinstock, then suddenly they're off, you know, kind of put to the side. So that's a little concerning to me. But again, you know, I there's a lot of information. A lot of information on all of this. And so there are a lot of differing opinions. There's a lot of emotion involved with it when you're dealing with obviously with a child. I did have concerns about the recommendation of sending the child to a facility when you got a doctor or her own psychologist saying, hey, this would be detrimental. You know, was there enough looking at what the impact to that child is before he made that recommendation to the court? So those would be, and also I guess a little bit concerned of the father making statements that, yeah, you know, Dr. Weinstein said this and that. It's like, you know, that he's doesn't think I have domestic, you know, violence. And you're right, Dr. Weinstein addressed that. Maybe it's just father being, you know, trying to provide his side of it. But, you know, you just want to make sure that someone's walking down the road in the middle and trying to look at both sides of these situations. And obviously, you know, information, to gather information and make recommendations based on what they have. But I just had concerns on the impact of the child and also how the other two psychologists.
And, you know, just in response to one of the points you made, when you said that, you know, he said, let's bring in some additional, provide a psychologist or forensic or psychologists that are familiar with the forensic side, which is something I know our board has talked about. You know, when you work in forensics, sometimes having people with that background may lend additional insights. So in a sense, I don't think he abandoned the other providers from what we've heard, but that let's get in more people involved so we can get more objective opinions, you know, because obviously all of this has been going on for a long time and there's no resolution. So what do you do then? You kind of come, you're going against a wall. And so then you start thinking of alternative solutions. And so you recommend some additional providers to go in and evaluate what is really going on, you know, because at some point, you know, many, you know, human beings, you know, we make up our mind and it's hard to see things from other perspectives. So bringing in somebody else, I thought was a great recommendation personally, because you're getting, again, a more objective view. And so we've had so many providers. Again, the Bridges program was a recommendation. Ultimately, the court would have to decide, if I'm not mistaken, from what I heard, what would be the next step, you know? But again, going back to what Dr. Davis-Wilson said too, these are professionals working. They know a lot more than I do. And they are looking at the history, the research, and how do we help the child, you know? And what is the treatment that is going to work in this particular situation? I cannot second guess that treatment. And I mean, there's so many providers talking about it, making their comments, there's differing views. And we know that happens in medical care, in all types of situations, you know? Sometimes there's no one right way to do something. You know, and there are different paths to achieve at the same goal. And these are all professionals providing their opinions and providing their recommendations and then making a determination of, you know, what is best or what's going to help the child, you know, taking into account actual factual information. I read through the whole deposition that the father did, every question that he answered in that deposition, you know, did you say this? He said, well, I said this and the mother said this, you know, I mean, that deposition, the way the father answered every question, you know, it's his word and it's his, and then he refuses to answer the question. First, he says multiple therapists. Then he says, nope, I cannot give you any name. Then he goes, well, Dr. Brady might have said that. And so for me to base that whole allegation based on that deposition is very, very difficult. So.
All right. Any other comments on the board? And I would agree, Dr. Mullett, you've very good points. And Dr. Davis, well, this is it's very complicated. A lot of different nuances involved in that. That's why it's good that we have a diverse group on this board. Dr. Mullett, you are the lead.
I really do not see a violation of our statutes and, in terms of Dr. Weinstock performing below the standard of care, you know. And so I would make a motion to dismiss. So.
And I would second that motion.
Okay. Any discussion?
Ms. Shreve, if I may, you know, the only other thing that I would say with that is I just want all parties to know that this doesn't dismiss our understanding of how significant and serious the proceedings are. I think it is always within, you know, due process for individuals to come forth with these concerns. I appreciate that this has been brought to our attention, and I don't want that to be overlooked, because I do know that these are very difficult. This is time consuming. This is costly by all parties, and we do recognize that, but we do have an obligation to, you know, review it in comparison to the statutes, and that is why I'm in agreement with Dr. Mullett.
Thank you for those. Yeah, I appreciate you saying that, because we do appreciate all of the information, because it really helped us then come to this conclusion.
All right. So did you second, right, Dr. Davis-Wilson?
I did.
You did. Okay. We got a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? I'll oppose. So the motion carries. And so the motion is dismissed. And I think that's the end
Thank you for your time, committee members.
Thank you. That is the last item on our agenda. I would like to thank staff before we go. Thank you for preparing all this information. Of course, our wonderful attorney, Jean Galvin, thank you for providing us with our legal advice and keeping me out of trouble on this. And we appreciate all of you that have attended so much. So with that, is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved. Oh, second.
I guess we're excited. All in favor, aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none. We are adjourned. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.